Good afternoon. This is a meeting of the Colorado Voter Access and Modernized Elections Commission. The date is August 26, 2013. It's 1 p.m. and we're meeting in the Aspen Room at the Secretary of State's office, 1700 Broadway, third floor. The first item, and just to let people know, I'm going to mix up the agenda a bit today. After public comment, I've asked the clerks from El Paso and Pueblo to call in regarding the recall rules and some of the issues we've heard regarding ballot delivery by email specifically, and they'll also be available for other questions the commission may have that's within the scope of the commission. First thing is invitation for public comment. I think I have three people signed up. The first one is Margaret Johansson.
Thank you. I'm Margaret Johansson from Boulder, Colorado. I'm also with Coloradans for Voting Integrity, CFVI, and we are a nonpartisan volunteer group working to make elections fair and a lot of other things that make it fair. We're concerned particularly with electronic voting and the problems that it has presented and is presenting. I'm not one of the top computer experts in the country, but CFVI is linked very closely with a national group that has many, many very exceptionally knowledgeable computer security experts. So we've got the last word on that stuff. So I'm interested in talking about rules connected with the recall election. I just got back into town, so I'm trying to catch up with what's going on, and I may lack for a certain specificity. But the basic thing about internet voting is that the internet isn't all that a lot of people think it is. It's a wonderful, wonderful tool for our society, but unfortunately it can't be made secure in the last analysis. This is quite unfortunate, but anybody that tells you differently is wrong. There are plenty of examples, and they keep getting more frequent, of large firms, even the military, Google, whatever, that have a lot of resources to make their communications secure that have been hacked. So that's some supporting evidence for what the scientists say, that elections can't be made secure using electronic voting, and that includes return of voted ballots by email. And even online registrations, because they're when they're electronic, are subject to hacking, unfortunately. And people have kind of let this part of the equation slide a little bit because the military has been pushing internet voting so assiduously, with talking in terms of how the military has a hard time getting their votes in. So there have been national legislative strengthening of the tools to get military and overseas votes in on time. And included was the option of getting a blank ballot online. But it's still, it's online. Registrations that are online are still hackable. And there was a recent example in the Miami-Dade area of 2,500 registrations that were created falsely. And it really wouldn't have come out if the Miami Herald, I think that's the name of it, hadn't really stuck to the story on this, because the government was going to kind of let it go without finding out who was behind it. And the only reason it got flagged was because so few sites were used to create these false registrations. But there could have been others that were less crude, and people anticipate in the future there will be a lot fewer such crude hacks. And then, of course, we know about the National Security Agency having access to all our emails, so that internet voting has, but just a little more proof that what's in our Colorado Constitution, that you should have a secret ballot, and that the legislature is charged with creating fair elections, that this kind of NSA power does not really allow us to observe our Constitution. Do I have any time left?
Well, it's up to you. At 1:15, we're going to break and take the phone call, so you can talk to that point, or we can hear from someone else.
All right. So as far as the rules go, if you possibly can, you should avoid internet voting, because you have two kinds of remote voting. Mail is remote because it's not, you know, there's not a chain of custody. You can't keep track of the ballots the way you can when people vote in the polling place, assuming good tactics and the ability to audit, legitimately audit the ballots. But if it's a good polling place, there are all these security things that have been built up over the years to protect votes. Once you get into mail, you've lost a lot of that. And of course, Colorado has gone along with that. But much worse is voting on the internet, because it can be hacked from anywhere in the world. So if you care about fair elections, you're going to avoid the use of emails, internet voting, or return of ballots. And I won't mention registration, because everyone kind of gives up at that point. But you're still likely to have problems with registration. So we have this small recall election, and it does seem that the rules have been stretched to include emergencies and things like that. So if there's some way of avoiding the use of emails for emergencies, it should be done. And Marilyn Marks seems to have figured out a way of balancing off, you know, working with all the specifics of time limits and so forth. And she's come up with a way to avoid internet voting. And I don't have time for, I don't have that. I won't go into that. But I would say they're too broad. There's, if you can possibly go for people who can't be at the polls, and you have to do a remote type, it should be mails, not internet. And of course, you do as good a job as possible with keeping track of the mail ballots to see that the public has oversight, and that there's all kinds of those checks and balances that you have had developed in polling places. All right, I'll stop there. Any questions?
Hi, this is Elena, for those on the phone. I have two questions. One, at the very end, you referenced that Marilyn Marks had a proposal to avoid all internet voting or reduce that risk or something like that. Mm-hmm. Do you have a copy of that you could share with the commission, or is that something that's been shared with the Secretary of State's office that could be distributed?
I'm sure it's available. I don't.
It can be gotten by email, right?
Okay.
That would be great if that could be sent out to the commission so we can look at that. And then my other question, just at the very beginning, you mentioned that you were linked closely with a national group. I didn't catch which group that was.
Well, it's called EVN, Election Verification Network, and that's sort of a historic term. You know, that's the way it kind of started out. But it includes some people from Common Cause, but a very wide group of people and many, many very reputable scientists.
And so were those comments today on behalf of EVN or just referencing the relationship you have with them?
We have access to information which would allow us, even though we're not one of those top scientists, to talk about it.
Okay, thank you.
And you know, there are also conferences that I've gone to, put on by NIST and so forth, that deal with this topic. Yes.
Well, thank you. That goes to my question. Does this national network, are there, is there any data available on attempts to use?
If you go on to Veritas, they have topics that flash by you, and one of them is internet voting. And that, then if you go to more information, once that comes up, you can press on a number of articles that are really very good.
And what was that, verified voting?
Verified voting.
Dot org.
Stretched out. Dot org.
Dot org, okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Do we have someone new on the line?
Wayne Williams, I'm here.
Great, Wayne. Thanks. We're just waiting for Bo. I'm going to try him real fast. Maybe I'll just start with sum up while we're waiting for Bo to get on the phone. One of the issues that we have had in this recall is obviously the timelines of attempting to have any kind of an election with only 15 days prior to the time that initiative petitions can be. Is he coming on?
He's joining.
Oh, he's joining. Okay. With the issue of 15 days prior to the time that the petitions can be turned in. That 15 days expires today. Once that Bo, are you on the line now?
I am.
Okay, great. I'm just going through the history of sort of the basic timelines that apply to both you and Clerk Williams, and then I was going to ask you to comment on this issue regarding internet voting versus mail. So the 15 days starts today. We then have a day to certify the petitions, which we've written into our rules, which would be tomorrow. The statute then allows 5 days of a protest period. That ends up being leaving 9 days, which is actually on September the 3rd. And then from there, There are some issues at the clerk's offices, and I think at that point I'll let them both handle them, but we cannot officially certify the ballot until 5 o'clock on September 9th, and that's by statute. So at 5 o'clock on September 9th, Clerk Williams, maybe you could start. Tell us what happens at 5 o'clock on September 9th. Or September 3rd.
Okay, because I was getting real panicked there.
Sorry.
Okay, once the ballot is certified, we can then proceed to provide ballots to folks. Our intent is to, in order to produce the necessary ballots and print them, that we'll be opening the voter service and polling centers in four locations on Thursday at 8 a.m., and then we'll open three additional sites the following Monday. We will then be also sending out ballots to individuals who have requested them, either through the emergency or through the excuse-based absentee for being out of county, and we'll be sending those out. In some cases, it takes a while to receive that ballot, and so it's important, and we've worked with the Secretary of State's office to ensure that folks who may be away still have the opportunity to vote so that they can participate in the election.
And specifically with the thought, I know that we all had discussions around the electronic delivery of the ballots, the electronic return of the ballots, the mail of the ballots, the mail back of the ballots. Can you talk a little bit about the timeline that is affected with the Postal Service in relation to that September 3rd date?
Well, it takes... You know, assuming you certify it at 5 o'clock, then we hope to be able to mail out the following day. And simply with postal delivery, and I guess let me back up. There are individuals who are covered UACAVA voters and those who are overseas. But we also have a number of El Paso County residents who live in Senate District 11 who have a permanent home in this district, but who live elsewhere for various reasons, whether it's a temporary position, school, and they range in location actually all the way from Maine to Hawaii. And so we did not feel that there exists the capability within the post office of assuring delivery of a ballot in a timely manner. And so we worked with the Secretary of State in terms of allowing, ensuring that these individuals are able to vote. We also have a number of individuals who are in nursing homes or who may be unable to leave their home because of medical reasons, maybe in the hospital. And so we had to make provisions for those individuals. And electronic transfer of a ballot. And it's important to note this is not voting on the Internet. It's simply the electronic transfer of the ballot. It goes back to 2005 in Colorado. It was adopted in Senate Bill 5-206, co-sponsored by a wide range of both Democrats and Republicans from now Congressman Doug Lamborn to Ken Gordon, kind of give you the range of folks that were co-sponsors of this legislation. And it allows the transfer in certain circumstances. And so given the exigent circumstances that are faced in this election in terms of timing and getting ballots back and forth, we felt it was appropriate to permit or to set up a process to transmit those ballots. It does, as provided by that statute explicitly, provides that those who are unable to come to their come to the polling place on election day because of a medical reason can electronically transmit the ballot back. But what would have to happen for that is they would have to receive the ballot, print it, fill it out by hand, sign it, and then scan it back in, either sending it via fax or creating a PDF or some other form of readable document that is then transmitted back to our office. For those who are out of county or out of state, because the language in the statute did not specifically provide for transmittal of the voted ballot back, those individuals will instead need to mail it back, and under the revised Secretary of State's rules issued on Friday, as long as it's postmarked by Election Day, that ballot will count if received within the 8-day window allowed for UACAVA voters. So we've tried to make provisions so that everybody has the opportunity to vote. Clearly, 1303, as the judge said, was fatally flawed in the sense and you can't mail ballots to people 18 to 22 days ahead of time if you don't even know who's on the ballot till 15 days ahead of time. And so we've come up with what I believe is a election system based on other provisions in Colorado law that provides a workable election system while still maintaining the integrity of the voting process and ensuring that every individual has the ability to vote who's legally entitled to do so.
Wayne, let me ask you a question that we've heard a little bit about over the emails we've gotten over the last week. How do you ensure somebody doesn't take a copy of that, make 100 copies, and vote 100 times?
Well, first, each one is, we have to tie each one to an individual, and the signatures have to match. And so if the signatures do not match, that ballot does not count. And so it's not just, it's not a piece of paper that anyone, that you can make 1,000 copies of and stick in a ballot box. Each ballot, and we do this right now with UACAVA voters, and we ensure that that ballot is, that signature matches. And if the signature doesn't match for some reason, we notify the voter, and that vote doesn't count until that voter confirms it's actually their ballot. And I know we've done that before in other elections with UACAVA ballots, and we'll certainly be doing it with this one. Every single ballot returned will be checked against the signatures on file, and it will not count unless it matches.
And can you briefly describe the duplication process and how that works with the statewide voter registration database to ensure people don't get double vote credit?
Yeah, when they are when we receive that ballot, they are given credit in score, and so as long as it is the same person, they will not be able to cast another ballot under that voter identification. And that is the absolute way in which that works. I would note I actually have an email back from the 2012 primary in which we didn't count the ballot of an individual who was in the military, and because the signature did not match, and the individual was then sent the necessary information in order to make that valid. So I know it is something that we've done in the past, and we will continue to do it with this election and every election in the future.
And Clerk Ortiz, if you could tell us a little bit about your process and what would happen on September 3rd after it was certified.
It's very similar to Clerk Williams' process, except we're opening at 11 places on September 5th. And what we'd like to do is actually open, you know, a few locations even before then, and I think we're in discussions with the Secretary of State's office on doing that, just so that we, you know, depending on the ballot language and depending on whether somebody actually enters their petition, being able to serve more of the public in a timely manner. So we look forward to finding out and negotiating with the Secretary of State on that issue. One thing that I'd like to bring up, so we're going to open, we'll be able to, like you said, because of the temporary adoption of the Secretary of State's rules, we will be able to get ballots to people that are in nursing homes, and we plan on, or in hospitals, or have an emergency reason why they can't do that. But what we like is to even expand that a little bit more when it comes to the absentee portion of the rule, and allow them also to be able to electronically submit their ballot if they wanted to. I think that's important, since some people, like what we've found out here in Puebla, we have a couple that are leaving on a cruise in Europe, and they want to be able to vote in this election. We don't have a ballot right now that we can give them so that they can vote it and submit it, and there's no way that they could mail it in time for us to get it even 8 days after the election if it's postmarked on 7 p.m. on Election Day. So we would like to the expansion of 13.7 Prinz F to even include people that making it a no-excuse absentee. So anybody that was expecting a mail ballot can use this process. Since this process is still checking their signature verification, I don't see why it couldn't be used for this either. And there's one thing that I wanted to correct or at least disagree with my partner in El Paso County. I don't believe it was a fatal flaw in 1303. I think it was a fatal flaw in the law and the Constitution that wasn't aligned. And I think that either way, this recall could have been effective by the same ruling, no matter if it was an all-mail or not. So I just wanted to put that out there, and I'm open for any other questions.
Anyone have any questions for either?
Thank you. My microphone. Thank you, Clerk Ortiz and Clerk Williams. This is Representative Rankin. I have a couple of questions. I'm trying to scope the problem sort of in my head, and maybe both of you could tell me about how many of these email-delivered ballots you anticipate in each category, just for I know that's impossible to accurately determine, but just do you have a prediction? I mean, how many of these email ballots will actually be sent out?
We have 645 UACAVA ballots, and those both Bo and I, Clerk Ortiz and I, have already mailed out the initial version of the ballot. If it changes either based on additional petitions being turned in or the absence of a write-in candidate or the changing of the wording of the question based on an advisory opinion asked or based on a request by Governor Hickenlooper to the Supreme Court, then we will be sending out revised ballots. And that's the hard number that we know. And for us, it was 645, and Clerk Ortiz sent just under 300, I believe. With respect to how many additional people will ask for it, that's something that I don't think either of us are in a position to know at this stage. We know that there are some individuals in healthcare facilities, and that's a relatively small number. But in terms of others who might be at home and unable to leave, I don't have an accurate count as to the number in Senate District 11. And with respect to those who live out of state, we do know right now we've got about 400, I believe, who live or currently temporarily reside out of state and have an address there. There are likely additional ones who are there for a temporary period of time who have not updated an address and score. So I wish I could give you a better and more current number, Representative Rankin, but this is one of those that until we get them in, we're probably not going to know the exact number.
And here in Pueblo County, we have very large health care facilities in our district, in Senate District 3, and it's going to be a challenge to be able to serve all those people with the regular ballots that they already get. And then there's quite a few people in these nursing homes that are there temporarily, and knowing that because my grandfather broke his ankle 3 weeks ago and is right now in a healthcare facility going through rehab in a nursing home or assisted living home, and who isn't going to get a mail ballot, who needs to request an emergency ballot, and then we need to find a bipartisan team to take that out to him. Or he can request one, one of my aunts or uncles, or even I believe, after he fills out the emergency ballot, can take it to him. He can make me his representative, and I could take it to him. So it's really tough to gauge how many people we're talking about any of this. But as far as the rule goes, we had 82,000 people that were expecting to receive a mail ballot on the 19th or sometime after that, and any one of those people can still request an absentee, so it's tough to gauge what those numbers are.
And that was sort of my next question, really. I mean, I assume we're going to take new requests going forward, and for absentee ballots and for the medical emergency ballot. And the way I read those medical emergency rules, I mean, you can interpret. I mean, if you're a caregiver for a family member or inconvenienced by a sick family member, then you could request an emergency ballot. So I'm a little bit concerned about the growth of based on new requests at the last minute. And are you comfortable that you can handle sort of an unexpected number of these requests?
This is Pablo. It's really hard for us to gauge. We expect to be ready to go and be able to service all those people up till 5 p.m. on election night, and hopefully get all of their requests out in time. But we're growing judges, and we're going to use bipartisan teams, judges, to take those emergency ballots when there isn't a person available to do that. And we hope to grow all the way to election day with as many people as we can get to help us with that. But like I said, they have to be bipartisan teams, so it's often difficult. Plus, you definitely want them to have a background check since they are handling a ballot and taking a ballot out. So, and then there's the question of, do you send a watcher, and how many watchers are allowed to go with each team to watch the process? So it is concerning, and it's going to be a tough process, but it's our job to enfranchise the voters as best we can, and that's what Pueblo County plans on doing.
And one thing that Clerk Ortiz and I talked about just this morning was the timing of the petitions. And if we do not receive a petition in Pueblo, it's our intent, and I had something intervening happen that Bo, that I needed to tell you, but that is that the case got set in Denver District Court on the rules for 10 a.m. on Wednesday. So my plan, or our plan for Pueblo, was to, if a petition is not turned in, to allow Pueblo to immediately start issuing ballots over the counter as early as Wednesday. And if we can coordinate that with the watchers, and the judges, then that may alleviate some of the absentee requests that we get, or some of the even the health care, because it may be that they can designate someone to pick up a ballot over the counter. But it would certainly allow for that extra week of time where people who have those extenuating circumstances could come in and take care of those issues and maybe alleviate some on the back end. Probably not a lot of help I can offer to El Paso, because I heard we are getting a petition there, which will then move their date into the next week. So that's where we stand. It is a continuing, evolving process because of these timelines and our desire to enfranchise as many as possible while still maintaining the integrity. We've been working very closely with the clerks and their staff to ensure that we're getting accurate information and to ensure that we're putting in every security point we can while still recognizing that this is a unique situation and we need to make sure that everybody who wants to vote has an opportunity to do so. Any other questions for?
Yeah, this is Martha Tierney on the phone. I apologize for joining late, but I'm a little busy. I had a question for the clerks. In terms of the way the rule is written right now, Clerk Williams, you indicated a few moments ago that when you were talking about trying to estimate how many people might be out of the county. When I read that rule, I want to find out how you are interpreting it in terms of, for example, people that might work out of county and would be out of county during the entire period where the polling locations would be open.
Sure. Our polling locations are going to be open 8 to 5 Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, 8 to 5 on Monday, and 7 to 7 on Tuesday. If someone is out of town for that entire, I think it's about 48 hours of time, if they're out of the county, they would have the capability of requesting a ballot, and we would send it to them, and then they would need to send it back by 7 p.m. on election day, and it would need to be postmarked with that, and then it needs to be received by our office no later than 8 days after the election, so September 18th.
Okay, so out of the county, even if that would be out of the county, but then returning to the county in the evening, but just not able to be there during those hours.
It would be out of the county during those hours, and so yep. That would include on Saturday. They'd have to be out of county
right.
on Saturday also.
Right. Okay.
But you know, I think that's what the rule, as I understand it, provides.
Okay.
So if you're flying in at 8 on Tuesday. Even though you would be in the county on a Tuesday, you would be out of the county during the time the polls are open. So that's when
right.
it would kick.
I wanted to thank the Secretary. This is Gilbert Ortiz in Pueblo County. I'd like to thank the Secretary of State's office for considering opening Pueblo County's polling locations on Wednesday. I really appreciate that. I don't know how many people are on the commission are bow hunters, but bow hunting season starts this week and lasts through the election. And we have a number of bow hunters that are going to be living in a camper for the next 10 or 12 days. And we're really concerned about getting their ballot. And being able to open on Wednesday would allow us to be able to serve those people much more efficiently than sending them or having them download a ballot somewhere out in the woods, which probably isn't possible, and then mailing them back to us. So we do appreciate that from the Secretary of State's office.
Well, and on behalf of El Paso County, I want to add to Bo's comments. This has been an extraordinarily challenging time frame. And with the decision by the Colorado District Court, with the issues that have been raised that are now in front of the Colorado Supreme Court, Secretary of State's office has been very good about listening to concerns, getting back to us, and including us in the process. And while none of us agree with everybody 100% of the time, I think the Secretary of State's office has done a very good job of responding under very difficult circumstances. So we appreciate their support and their assistance.
Representative Rankin again. I remain troubled by the fact that we don't have a real good estimate of the workload and what this is going to be like, but I have a related question. It really goes back to Martha's question. I mean, if we're asking interpretations of what an absentee voter is, I think there's a lot of room here because this is coming out late. It's an unusual election. It's a lot of latitude here for misinterpretation by the public. I think we're likely to get a lot of people requesting absentee and medical ballots because they don't completely understand the rules or what it is you're trying to do. I'm very concerned that, you know, we don't have enough public information. Are you doing anything to let people know what they can and cannot do under these rules?
Representative Rankin, I think those are very legitimate questions. We actually have going out in the mail today a mailing to all of the voters in Senate District 11 that's going to outline what their options are, explain that it is a polling place rather than a mail ballot election, let them know what the process is if they need something other than that, and then also trying to encourage them to vote in the first 3 days of the VSPC, so we're giving them an express pass that they can take care of some things more quickly, so trying to encourage that turnout earlier as opposed to later. And that's really, I think, in part what we're trying to encourage folks and make sure they all know what's going on. We're also working entirely with our public information officer to convey information to the press, and we're issuing media releases pretty much on a daily basis with whatever the latest update is, and also putting that information on our webpage so that folks can access those applications directly. I do share your concern about a workload issue if we get 10,000 applications at 5 o'clock on election day. And so I don't think that's going to happen, and we're trying to work with the parties and candidates, all of whom we've sent this information out and encouraged them to get people to let us know sooner rather than later. But that's what we're doing, and so we are trying to communicate as best we can, and everyone at least will get a mailing from us, as well as information from the media, all of whom have been pretty good about getting the word out on things.
And my hopefully last concern is that, you know, we're making a lot of assumptions here on the issue of security. I really feel that we haven't looked at other states and other test cases in our own experience enough to really make sure that we've satisfied ourselves on the computer security issues. And I also don't think we've had opportunity to hear all the public input on this. I mean, we've got people sitting here yet to testify on probably on the same subject. So my question really comes down to this. What are we doing here that we will not be doing in the November election? I'm having a hard time sorting out in my own head what's special here. What will not carry forward into our rules related to future elections? And maybe that's a question for the Secretary of State.
Well, this is Wayne Williams, El Paso. I'll at least take an initial response. There are a number of things we're doing that we're not going to be doing for the coordinated election in November. In that election, everybody will be mailed a ballot, and so I anticipate that the number of people coming into the voter service and polling centers will be fairly small. And because everybody will be mailed a ballot, the need for emergency ballots or other things like that is very narrow. And so it's a very different situation. Here we are talking about most people coming into the voter service and polling centers and voting. And so a lot heavier demand. When we've had a similar type system for mail ballot primaries, we've had fewer than 1,000 people in the entire county who went into the service centers to vote. And so I think these are two entirely different situations because for the coordinated, that'll be a mail ballot election. And as I knock on my desk here, hoping that there isn't some lawsuit that throws that one into a situation. But I don't think there are. But then again, I never would have thought someone would claim the Colorado Constitution is unconstitutional. So my ability to predict future behavior is admittedly limited.
But you are predicting human behavior. You're not talking about the rule difference. And my feeling is that once we, if the rule stays the same and you're just predicting a future based on human behavior, people are going to get used to requesting and in some cases returning their ballots by email. Once we go down that path and train people to do that and get them used to that convenience, I don't see us pulling back very easily from that.
Well, and I think that uniformed overseas voters are already very familiar and used to doing that. I think the majority of those people overseas send back their ballot via email and like the system very much that the Secretary of State's office has developed. And I think you're right. I think that sooner or later people are going to see that internet voting and they're going to want to do it in a as a convenient and transparent way of voting, just like we're doing mail and polling place elections now. So I think you did say something in there that alludes to the future of voting, and I think the security is there, obviously, since we're already allowing uniformed overseas voters to vote that way, and how much importance we carry with those uniformed overseas voters, since they are out there protecting our democracy and participating in it at the same time. So, you know, I think you're right. I think there is some a future discussion to come about email voting and how do we implement that or how do we approach that in the future.
I would note, I think, one important distinction, though, is that this is something under a set of extraordinary circumstances. And so in the future, that discussion would need to be addressed legislatively, just like it was with the UACAVA legislation, just like it was with respect to emergency ballots for those in a hospital. And so that would be a legislative debate that will take place in the future. In this case, these are very narrow circumstances, and I don't think the fact that it is available under these limited circumstances is going to cause people to think that it is always going to be available, particularly because most of them, actually all of them, will receive a ballot automatically in mid-October for this next election by mail. And so it'll be there are some significant differences.
And
while I agree with my my fellow clerk, there are situations where we have used this for regular voters and not uniformed overseas voters. Last year during the hurricane, there were a number of Colorado citizens that were stranded on the East Coast that did use electronic transmission as their way of voting for the presidential election.
And the other thing I'd add to the Clerk Ortiz's comments, we had the fire here in El Paso County over the primary election. There were instances in which certain individuals had to receive a ballot via electronic transmission. And so, yes, as I mentioned, electronic transmission was adopted back in 2005 and has been used in a number of instances in limited circumstances where it was needed.
And this is Suzanne, and I mean, the big difference here is legislative, and the reason that it's being done this way in this election is that a lot of our statutory framework is unusable. If there were, as Clerk Williams pointed out, a desire to use email in a, I guess, more uniform type way, then that would be something that the legislature would have to address. And I guess I disagree with Clerk Ortiz that I think it's secure now. I don't really think it's been tested, and I think we've, you know, done what we can in terms of making sure that our everyone counts system is a good system and that we haven't had problems, and we've tested that. But as to the internet itself, an ability to hack into a system, that kind of thing, we just really don't have that kind of information, and I think we are quite a ways off from getting it. The other thing to keep in mind about this emergency voting provision when we talk about Sandy and we talk about the fire is that we were issuing those as replacement ballots. And so the people had already received a ballot by mail but had ended up in a situation where they could not return that ballot. And so we emailed out those ballots and got those ballots back as replacement ballots, much like we used to do over the counter if you had a replacement ballot. In this particular case, there is no original ballot. So the ballot that you're essentially replacing is the one that you would have voted at the polls. So there are some very important distinctions to be made in this case that I think point to why we had to do it this way. But in the law, there is not a mechanism for this kind of open email return of ballots. And certainly in the November election, although we're looking at it for the cases of emergencies, it will be for, again, replacement ballots. So somebody who's in a nursing home or somebody who ends up hospitalized after they obtain their ballot can apply for emergency ballot because they need to replace it. So that's a very different thing than what we're doing in this case. I think, like Clerk Williams, I don't think people are going to get used to it, because a couple of weeks after this election's done, they're going to receive their regular ballot in the mail. And they're going to understand that that is the system we use in Colorado. We don't have the authority by rule, except in a case like this, where we don't have any other statutory guidance. We don't have authority in rule to just declare email ballots open or to override rules that have already been given to us. We're an executive agency, and our job is to implement the statutes and the laws given to us by the legislature. And that's what we're attempting to do in this election and what we will attempt to do in each following election. I do want to thank Clerk Ortiz and Clerk Williams. I know this has been really difficult on your staff as these continuous changes. I think someone in my office described it as kind of a whiplash as we start and stop and start and stop. I know it's been, you know, an incredible strain on the staff, and appreciate you all working with us. And I think that that collaboration has helped a lot in coming up with policies that we believe we can all implement in a way that will provide integrity for this election. So thank you both very much. I think we have one more question.
Thanks, Suzanne. This is Elena Nunez again. I share some of the concerns that have been raised about voter confusion and voter education. And one of the things that strikes me is that we've, over the last many years, gotten voters used to a no-fault absentee and then permanent vote-by-mail situation where ballots are automatically delivered, and certainly that was the framework of 1303. My question is, I guess this is limited to Pueblo, given the timing of candidate petitions and the likelihood that the ballot can be certified more quickly, if there's been any exploration of the feasibility of issuing a mail ballot automatically to every voter the way that the statute intended, given that there's that extra week of time and what that would look like. I'm concerned, since voters aren't used to voting in person and we don't have as many polling places as we traditionally did, that we're putting a real strain on voters, and I'm wondering about that as a possibility.
This is Gilbert Ortiz in Pueblo County. I have the same concerns, Elena, and I have been pushing my vendor, which is also El Paso's vendor, to give us timelines if something was certified on the 27th, on the 28th, 29th, when it comes just to the paper ballots in our office. Last week I thought, you know, if nobody put in a petition, there might be a possibility to send out mail ballots, so I pushed them on a timeline for that also. And they basically told me, you know, with all the checks and balances that we do with mail ballots, with the auditing of ballots to make sure that they're all correct, and I understand that there's only one one ballot style, so it's not like they can get the wrong ballot in their envelope, but there is still concerns about their addresses and having to pull ballots if they changed addresses and different things that happen, that it would not be possible for them to get it out in a timely manner where they would be able to get it back. It would go out in batches, and likely the last half of the batches would be in such a short time frame that they wouldn't be able to get it back to them. And we couldn't assure that it would be delivered to their address correctly also. So we're looking not only at, you know, the ballots the ballot packets being constructed, but we're also concerned about the delivery by the United States Postal Service being timely. And then just being as accurate as possible, like we always are, it's very important for us to make sure that the right people are getting the right ballots and not getting duplicate ballots or any other kinds of ballots like that. So our vendor just didn't feel comfortable going forward in that time frame.
Thank you. This is Angela Hedon. It'd probably be no surprise to anybody on the commission or either the two clerks. I've probably been at more than 2,000 doors here in Senate District 3, and the amount of voter confusion is so alarming. I can't even tell you. And then again, I mean, even what I was giving to them 6 weeks ago versus what I'm saying today is different. So I'm giving out different information as I'm trying to help voters get to have their voices heard when they're having to pay for the most expensive election that Pueblo County has ever seen, and then not to have their voices heard is really quite disturbing, to be honest with you. And to be able to inform our 80,000 plus voters about what they need to do when it's so different than what they've been doing in the past, it's really disappointing to hear, Bo, that the vendor is thinking they can't get out the ballots to be able to help people have their voices heard. I hadn't heard that, so I'm really frustrated, to say the least, to the people in Senate District 3 having to pay for an election which many of them won't even be able to have their voices heard.
Well, I completely agree with you, Senator, and you know, that's why I think that it's so important to take a look at this, the new rule from the Secretary of State's office, and reevaluate whether people can use this absentee even if they are in county, rather than outside a county. I think we really need to take another look at that part of the rule and allow anybody to have access to absentee like it's been in the past.
Right, and what I also would say is people were sharing how challenging and difficult this has been from the Secretary of State's office to the two counties, that I just want to thank you, Clerk Ortiz, for doing every single thing you can by opening up 11, by staying open on Sunday, to making sure that as many people that we are able to educate about where they need to go and when they can go. I just want to publicly thank you for doing everything you can. And I mean, this has nothing to do with me. I think that people who are paying for an election, that they should be able to vote, and I don't care darn how they vote, but I would like them to have their voices heard, and I thank you for doing everything within your power to make that happen.
Thank you, Senator.
And just a follow-up, this is Elena again. It is frustrating to hear that the vendor doesn't think it's possible, although, you know, maybe there's some room to figure out how to push that deadline or look at return and what that looks like. I have real concerns about allowing ballots to be returned electronically. I think there is a body of evidence that shows that it's not secure, but at the same time, I think we do need to make sure that every voter can vote in these elections. So I would just encourage your office to continue to be creative the way that you have been and work with the Secretary of State's office to look for ways to make sure that voters are able to participate. I did have one more follow-up question, which I think is for Suzanne. You mentioned that there was another hearing on Wednesday. Can you talk a little bit about that rules challenge and what's going on there?
It's not actually a rules challenge, whenever that was. 2 weeks ago in Judge McGahee's courtroom when the initial ruling came down. We told Judge McGahee at the time that we would be coming up with rules and submitting them to the court, in part to give parties notice as to what rules we intend to abide by during the recall, and then in part or in hope that Judge McGahee would look at those and make some determinations as to the constitutionality of some of them, obviously allowing an additional 8-day period to return ballots is technically a violation of the statute. That's only allowed for UOCAVA. There's a number of other technical issues with the rules, and so we wanted the court to be able to look at them and see if they had any huge issues prior to the time that we would, you know, start issuing ballots over the counter or service center. There's a second lawsuit, too, that was filed last week, which was, well, it's not a lawsuit, but we sent a set of interrogatories to the governor's office to the Supreme Court asking for some guidance on another issue in the Constitution that has to do with the layout of the ballot. Simply put, the provision states that if you don't vote on the recall, then your vote is not counted on the election of the successor. The interrogatory asks the Supreme Court to rule on that, and it does affect the layout of the ballot. At this point, we're going to go ahead and print the layout according to the Colorado Constitution, even though we have some concerns about its violation of First Amendment rights. We believe we could mitigate that at the polls by putting up signs and giving out other instruction on how to vote, but we do need to move forward in getting prints. So. I think we're going to move to the next item in the agenda, but just again wanted to thank Clerk Williams and Clerk Ortiz for joining us today and giving us all some answers. I think we really learned a lot from the conversation.
Thanks. We're going to get back to work.
Agreed. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Ooh. All right. And moving back to... the next person was Justin Morris. Oh, okay. Then Mary Eberly.
Hi, committee members. Mary Eberly, 1520 Crest Court, Boulder, Colorado. And I am a co-founder of Citizen Center and a member of Coloradans for Voting Integrity and Colorado Voter Group. I wish the clerks hadn't signed off because I had a few words for them. I do have a message. If the senator is still listening, to please tell your voters to go to the polls. That's a guaranteed way to be able to get a ballot and be able to vote in private in a polling booth and secretly cast your ballot into a ballot box. That's the best way to vote. Best way.
Are you sure? I'd love to be able to respond to that. That's what I have been telling them, but I've only got, there's 80,000 some voters in this county, and I can only go to so many doors, even if I'm walking every single day, and volunteers are out there walking every single day. So, yeah, I would. If you give me more time, I'll get to every voter and let them know that they can go to a election site. You know, you might hear some sarcasm. This is really frustrating to know that people in my county are not going to be able to know where to go, that the confusion is so bad. When they've been on a permanent mail ballot for over 10 years, and that's what they're still expecting. Many are still expecting that, and many are not knowing where they can go vote. So I appreciate that. That's what we are telling them, but I can't get to 80,000 before September 10th.
Thank you, Senator. This is Mary Eberly. That's definitely the right thing to tell them. And, of course, then they can tell their relatives and friends, so it will spread. That's good. And that's not only good for them as voters, but for the whole process. It's the best way to vote. Let's see. I'm hoping, I understood that Clerk Williams was going to be sending information out to his voters, probably mentioning the availability of email to request emergency ballots. And, of course, I haven't seen this document he's sending out, but if that's in there, I wish he would not send that out with that type of suggestion, because the experience in New Jersey last November was very bad, and lots of people who were not eligible asked for ballots, and when people didn't receive the ballots they asked for, they asked again and again, and the systems crashed from having too many emails coming in, and the ballot files were large and caused other problems and weren't received often by voters, and it just is not a good way to do this. So please don't promote that to anyone. In Pueblo, it seems that you could ask the Secretary of State to certify tonight, and I know the deputy mentioned after the Wednesday hearing, but since the ballot appears not to be going to change and it's already been certified, it would be, it seems reasonable, since no more candidates will be added, to go ahead and certify the ballot that you've already got, and then you could start printing and send ballots out to the relatively few people who need to receive them. You could send them by U.S. mail. I personally use U.S. mail to send CDs back and forth across the country, and they, I think only once have taken longer than a week, including the weekend. So it just, it seems unlikely to me that you can't reach all your voters using U.S. mail if you work to get these ballot contents certified speedily. Now, that's not going to help El Paso quite so much. El Paso possibly could ask for a shorter certification time. It's been suggested to get your have the petitioners get their signatures in yet, you know, essentially right now. Don't wait till the end of the working day today. And for the Secretary of State's office to treat the verification of these signatures as the emergency, not the voting, get those signatures checked and get that ballot content certified as quickly as possible. And then have El Paso be able to use U.S. mail without any problem. The UOCAVA voters in our state who are using email to return their ballots, UOCAVA, the overseas and military voters, they are violating the law if they are returning their ballots by email if it is not an emergency. In other words, if there's, they can only do it legally. They can only use email to return their ballots legally if there is no more secure means of returning the ballot available to them. And they do have 8 days for the ballot to be received after the election day. Really, we should be dealing with these voters who need to request ballots other and not vote at the polls as excused absentee voters. We shouldn't be using the emergency rule. 1303 does not allow the method that's being proposed and that probably is being advertised by clerks to the voters. 1303 only allows replacement ballots to be emailed, and that only on election day, only if it's a replacement that's needed on election day, not before. How can there be an emergency, an election day emergency already? We haven't had it yet. We should be following the old law. In the past, an emergency mail ballot could be issued only when the emergency, I hope you can hear me, there's a siren going by, only when the emergency occurred after the time for applying for a mail ballot. You know, for instance, a person having to go into the hospital for emergency surgery or something like that. being out of the county on work is planned. It's not an emergency. So it's not a good philosophy. So I'd like to read through three scenarios that have been proposed. I hesitate to do this in a way because it may be letting bad guys get ideas. But I think that it's important to get into the record that email is just a bad way to move ballots around, either to deliver them from the clerk to the voter or from the voter to the clerk. One easy way to commit fraud would be, an example of it would apply to the El Paso County recall petitions. Over 15,000 fresh signatures on these petitions. They're public record. Lots of people have copies. The petitions have the signatures and the addresses of the Senate District 11 voters. This should scare the candidates for Senate District 11. A bad guy can take that list and make up an email address, you know, on Gmail. We've all done it. For each of thousands of those people, submit the ballot application referencing one of the many available databases of Social Security numbers and driver's license numbers that are for sale. The clerk can send the request for the ballot would go to the clerk, and the clerk would send the ballot to the fake email address. The, quote, bad guy would print it, put on the scanned signature, just using common household scanner technology, which has been shown to pass through SCORE with no trouble. Sign the waiver, or use the scanned signature for the waiver and on the envelope, and now you have thousands of ballots in no time that you can submit, and there, it's not going to be, that this fraud would not be able to be caught. It's a huge risk, and we should just send the ballots by first-class mail, not standard mail, not whatever slow mail is being proposed, but first-class mail, just get them out. Here's another type of fraud that could happen. A well-meaning person makes lots of copies of his or her ballot and gives the ballots to friends to vote without understanding that the voter is not to, that's something the voter is not to do. The voter thinks he has an official ballot that anyone can vote. People vote those ballots. You know, friends, relatives. We all get these emails that are passed around, and these voters are probably eligible voters, but they don't realize that they were supposed to actually apply to get their own ballot, and they send in their ballots and put their return address on the envelope, and now the clerk has a dilemma. Should these ballots not be counted, even though the people were well-intentioned? It's going to cause a lot of confusion about roll your own ballots. And then the third method would be to get copies of the mail ballot applications that the clerks have received, get those copies daily, print a ballot for each person who's to receive or to who has received a ballot, just print it out and send it into the clerk before the real voter has time to reply. So the bad guy has the signature database and fresh petitions. They can be scanned on, and the bad guy won't get caught. Bad guy can edit the ballot to match the ballot number assigned to that voter. And these are just three possibilities. People are hacking things via the internet, hacking email, hacking websites, hacking databases on a moment-to-moment basis these days. We should not be putting our elections at risk, and it's not even legal to do this. The only place in 1303 that mentions this has to do with emergencies on election day, and this is just a bad approach, and I am hoping that the concerns that have been expressed by Margaret Johansson, who is an expert in the hazards of internet voting, including email voting, will be taken very seriously by the Secretary of State's office. I really appreciate A lot of the things that the Secretary's office has been doing to help this sort out this crazy situation, but having this rule that's allowing internet distribution of ballots and internet of receipt of ballots by the clerks, that's just not a good idea. And please treat the emergency as the certification of the signatures, not the election itself, because we have time for it not to be an emergency. Thank you.
No comment, not a question. We are attempting as a commission to capture all of these potential problems and scenarios where things might go wrong. And I don't think we have your specific scenarios here in this handout. Maybe we do. But if you'd like to submit those, we will put them in our record and attempt to make sure that we follow up as best we can. We have a lot of them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rankin. I'll be sure that those are submitted.
All right, thank you. The next item on our agenda, going back to the start, is the SLI weekly briefing. Thank you for your patience.
Oh, no problem. Good afternoon. Let's see. If we look at page one of the status report, and I think the accomplishments for last week and then the accomplishments for the plans for next week, which is this week, kind of covers it. As we're approaching our deadline for our report, the final report should be sent to the commission by Friday. So looking at accomplishments for last week, we received 46 written surveys back from the 64 counties. We're in process of compiling and analyzing those results. We sent out 59 telephone interview requests. This is slightly out of date. We actually got one new one today, so we received 27 confirmations. I think we've conducted 25 so far as of noon today. We're compiling those results, and the telephone interviews were actually something that we were originally planning on just doing through last Friday, but we did get some last minute confirmations to be able to do it this week. Some of the county clerks were a little bit busy last week and weren't able to do it, so we're trying to accommodate them by doing 5 or 6 additional phone interviews today and tomorrow. So we'll be finishing that up tomorrow late morning, I think. And we continue to process all the interview results, both written and telephone. We're looking at the results in part, you know, trying to assess what the counties feel they need help from the state, primarily in a number of different areas. The written survey was a total of 10 questions. The telephone survey consisted of 17 additional questions. Let's see. We're continuing our write-up examining the different voting systems that are available potentially for certification by the state into the future. And again, we're looking at kind of multiple categories. One category is systems that have already been certified by the EAC, so we'd only need additional Colorado certification. We're looking at systems that may have been tested by other states, not the EAC or Colorado, so that would be a different combination of requirements to be tested to, as well as systems that are not tested by any of those entities, the EAC, Colorado, or a different state. We're looking at different types of technologies, traditional voting systems, similar to what's in use by Colorado right now. We're looking at potentially, you know, different technologies, some of which have been discussed to different levels here today, electronic ballot delivery, internet voting, any potentially viable type of voting system into the future, you know, regardless of I guess, you know, the opinions out there as to whether they're truly viable or not. Right now we're trying to keep the door open and consider anything and everything, and that would be up to kind of the commission, the state legislature, and you know, the open public to make that decision later on down the road. So let's see. We're also working on cost estimations. We've sent out requests to multiple voting manufacturers. We've only received one response back. And so we're looking at that one response. We're going to try to extrapolate that as best we can, assuming we don't get any additional responses back from the voting manufacturers. I think one issue with that has been that I know that the state has sent out an RFP to manufacturers regarding new voting systems and costing and that, and some of the feedback we've gotten informally from a couple of different voting manufacturers was that they don't want to be answering it, A, in two different places, and there was just concern from a competitive viewpoint with each other to be giving it to a third party such as SLI. And even though we, you know, try to, you know, give them the, what's the word I'm looking for? Confirmation that we would keep it, for lack of a better word right now, that we would keep it confidential. But so we're not expecting a lot of return at this point. Senator or representative?
Yeah, how do you feel about your ability to do a good study with just that limited input? I thought trading off vendors and while I'm at it, how do you feel about the sample you have from the counties? Are you really going to have enough data to put together a good report?
Well, I think you have to look at the report that there's multiple aspects to it. The cost estimation was just one of them. I think the cost estimation will be lacking, one sample in for a pricing probably doesn't make a good survey in terms of that. But I think in looking at the rest of the report, some of the things that we were tasked with doing was, you know, talking to the counties, seeing how they felt as far as how they were best or how they were going to be able to meet HB 1303 in the year 2013 as well as 2014 and 2015. And I think with the written and the telephone surveys that we received back for something like that, I think we have a pretty good sampling. If you look at the counties that responded, it was a good sampling, both in terms of population. We had some very small counties respond, as well as some very large counties respond, and then also in terms of geography. We've had some counties that were very, you know, geographically small counties that would have, you know, fewer potential issues as opposed to very geographically large counties and, you know, kind of diverse, you know, from being plains to mountains and that type of thing. So I think when we look at the report in terms of that aspect, I think we'll have a pretty solid write-up on that. I think when we talk about the report in terms of the voting systems, both current and future, just from a technological point of view, I think, you know, we have a pretty good foundation of information for that. You know, we know what systems have been EAC certified. We know what their capabilities are due to that certification. We're also aware of a lot of new systems that are coming out. And even though we may not, you know, truly know what their true capabilities are at this point, we do have an understanding of what their technologies are and how they, what they may offer that are different from current traditional systems. SLI does have the good fortune, I guess, to we have a significant amount of experience with what might be considered non-traditional voting systems. We actually did work about a year and a half ago with FVAP on the UOCAVA project, and we did a lot of actually testing of the UOCAVA requirements, which were based off of the EAC's 2005 EVSG, and we tested six different non-traditional voting systems against those requirements. So we have a pretty good feel for how those systems are, and so we feel pretty positive about that. Representative, does that answer your question? Okay, thanks. So as I mentioned a little bit earlier, we are projected to finish the report, be finalized by Friday of this week. We're tasked with giving a draft report by Wednesday morning. We're pushing, a request was made last week to see if we could get it out a little bit sooner to give the commission a little bit more time to review it. So we're working hard to try to get it out, at least in a draft form, a little bit earlier to give you guys a little bit more time to look at it. And we're hoping to be done midday tomorrow to give you an extra half day or something to look at it. So I guess that kind of concludes my review. If there's any other questions?
This is Elena Nunez. Thank you so much for all your work pulling this together. It seems like in order for us to look at the draft report, if we get it tomorrow or Wednesday, it seems that there's a couple things that might be helpful. Do you have background materials from the interviews, the telephone interviews, that can help kind of support the conclusions that are in the report that you can share with the commission and or the written surveys so we have that?
We do, yeah, and that was actually going to be an attachment.
Oh, perfect. Report, okay, so. Great. So then that's perfect. We'll have that. And then I guess my second question is more for the rest of the group, which is just how do we need to finalize it so we can turn around feedback? Do you need it from us close a business Friday to have something finalized for the Tuesday meeting, or is there an earlier deadline in order to get the report done?
Well, I guess it depends on when you – want it to be done. We were really aiming more towards end of day Friday to being finished. If you care more that we have a finished product for the meeting on Tuesday, end of Friday would probably be doable to have a finalized report Tuesday. So that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we decided, or the statute requires that we transmit the report on Tuesday the 3rd, because we decided that since the 2nd's a holiday, it pushes back. But then in order to actually get our feedback incorporated, maybe this group needs to connect either on a conference call or over email by end of the day Thursday. Is that right? Jesse's nodding. Anyone on the phone? Does that timeline work?
This is Martha. That works.
Yeah.
This is Steve.
This is Brand,
and we would have to conduct that meeting by conference call because it would need to be an open public meeting.
Oh, great. So we can we notice that for what time works?
Are we going to do it by email or by a meeting? I'm up for the email.
If we do it over email, can we just post
the responses?
Or we can, but logistically well? That is much more difficult.
Oh, okay.
So my suggestion would be, in order to ensure that we have captured the complete record, to do that meeting by conference call.
So maybe we set a conference call, and if people can't join, they can just email their comments, and we can make sure they get included that way, too.
That would work, yes.
That would work great. Thanks. This is Hillary.
Now, the only potential issue with the emailing, too, is if you have two different conflicting comments, mm-hmm. I mean, then that would have to be resolved.
So what about, I'm just going to throw out a time to keep this moving, 2 o'clock on Thursday? Does afternoon work for folks? Yeah. And then that way, if we get the draft by Wednesday, we have time to review and then connect.
Sorry, Elena, can you say that again so you meet?
Oh, sure, sorry. I was.
When is the first draft?
We're hoping, I think the plan is to get the first draft of the report tomorrow afternoon, but no later than Wednesday morning. So then I was suggesting that we convene a call Thursday afternoon, maybe 2 o'clock.
I thought you said Tuesday afternoon. My bad. I thought you said Tuesday afternoon. That was what.
Oh, sorry. Yeah,
I'll be submitting my comments by email, but I'll definitely have them by Tuesday at 2.
We're talking about doing a conference call on Thursday at 2 to talk about the report and any edits we have.
Can't do it, but it's a good idea. And this is Martha. Would the conference call would only be necessary if there is any conflict in the email comments? Do I have that right? So we would first do email comments and then, to the extent there were anything that conflicted, we would have a conference call to resolve that?
Hi, Martha, this is Jessie. I would actually suggest we have the call, period. But I have a question. Is the timeline that we've got here, we get the report, we can review it either Tuesday or Wednesday. We submit some email changes if you can't make the call or even prior to making the call. And then is that when the commission signs off on the report, or when does that happen?
I would propose that we submit our feedback to SLI coming out of the Thursday call, and then at Tuesday the 3rd at our meeting then finalize the report and then make plans to share it with the legislature.
I agree with that.
Okay. Is there any objection on the phone to that?
Can you say that one more time, Elena?
Sure. So I think the proposal on the table is to have our conference call on Thursday at 2 p.m. On that call, we will discuss any edits or changes that people have to the report. We'll then share that with SLI to finalize a draft that we'll then vote on at the September 3rd meeting.
Okay, perfect. I'm aligned to that.
Mr. Martha, that's fine with me.
Yeah, our chair
this is Fran, that's good.
Our chair is out of the room, but I think that's a consensus. So.
Yeah.
Great.
And does that work for a meeting space?
So we have an incredibly tight conference room scheduled this week. I'm seeing plenty of room on Friday, even in the morning, and a small wedge of room between 11 and 1 on Thursday. And those are the only two available slots where we could conduct a conference room. We could do 4 o'clock on Thursday. And that's pretty much what we've got. 8 o'clock on Thursday is another option.
8 o'clock or 4 o'clock?
I vote 4.
Excellent.
4.
Yeah, 4.
Looking we'll like an early morning.
And how much time should we allot?
How long is the report? How many pages?
It'll be about 22 to 24 pages. I don't.
2 hours.
I wouldn't call it real heavy reading, though. I think it's. I think it flows well.
If we can, I would suggest saving 2 hours, and if we don't need it, then we get done early. But when we went through line by line on the first report,
It was
pretty slow.
Okay.
And if you're able to join us for that, that would be helpful, too, so you can hear the discussion. And we'll also write up our comments to give to you. But if you're able to be there, that would be great.
I can definitely participate.
Okay, so 4 o'clock Thursday, and we can meet in person at Blue Spruce. Otherwise, call in, and you'll send the number, Stephen?
Correct.
Great, thank you.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Well, do we have
Angela?
Yeah. Senator Heron, are you still on? Do you want to take over? Suzanne stepped out of the room. That's all right. I'll do it. Next up, we have a business practice subgroup update. Hillary, were you going to update folks on?
I was. I believe it was included, but I didn't check for sure. I sent Stephen an Excel early this morning. Do you all have that? Otherwise, this is going
to
be kind of...
We're having a little bit of trouble hearing you, Hillary, so we're just trying to turn the phone up a little bit.
Oh, sorry. I'll scoot a little closer to my phone as well. So I sent an Excel this morning, and I didn't look to see if it got included in the packet or sent out.
That was included in the commission packet.
Great. So if you guys can turn to that, and it should have said draft in the watermark, but I forgot how to do that, so it's not there. But this is the draft of probably 3 or 4 weeks ago, we presented the regular process flowchart for voters going through a voter service and polling center. Then we went and looked at the exceptions, and this is the recommendations, and again, it's a draft, so we'll circulate it to the other counties as well, of how to handle the exceptions that may occur in a voter service and polling location. At this point, I don't know what level of detail you all would like to go through it. So I will leave that to the group of how would you like to proceed with reviewing this, or do we want, I'll leave it to the group. I will add that depending on, not the meeting on the 3rd, but either the 9th or 16th, we'll also have a demo for you all of showing you how this works in SCORE and what it looks like, as well as we'll go over the ballot processing portion to show you how a ballot makes its way through the system as well. So with that, how would you like to proceed?
Hillary, I think we're all just reading for a minute.
I heard page turning, so I was pausing myself. I'm like, I think people are looking at it.
We're thinking very hard, yes.
And we can also review it in context of showing you how things work in SCORE if that's also, if that is more helpful. Or we can do both.
Representative Rankin, I just have sort of a related question. We're going to have to talk about how provisional ballots get treated, because it looks like we'll be creating quite a few. So put that on, maybe talk about that at another session.
So just to go have us go over how provisional ballots are processed?
Yeah,
is that what you're...
Yeah, how are we going to resolve those? Because, you know, given if these issues occur very often, we're going to have a stack of provisionals after the fact that need to be resolved.
And I think due to some of the changes, we should actually have fewer, and we are happy to review what current law covers for them, and we believe that it covers, that's still applicable, but we're happy to go over it, and if you want, we can add that to, Suzanne had asked us to, you know, see if we could put, the clerks could put together a pretty heavy agenda for the 9th, since that's the day before the recall, and I guess that's a question for this group. Do we want to meet the day before the recall, or we could also do it on the 16th right after the recall, and we can go through the provisional process then as well, if that would be helpful to see the whole, all of that in one meeting.
16th is fine, yeah.
Okay. That would take up a good portion of the agenda, just so people know.
Hey, this is Jesse again. Quick question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that this was going next to, from the business practices group to the clerks, or did I get that wrong?
We're going to put it out for public comment.
Okay.
First starting with the clerks to make sure we got it right, and then after that for others.
Will that be completed before the 16th?
Well, it can be completed. The question is as we're heading into a time where it's challenging to have the clerks engage, which is why we had a representative group take a look at it to begin with, but I still think it's worth posting for others if they're interested.
I guess I was just wanting to make sure we got, and I understand you've got a good group to start it, but if there were any changes, we'd be seeing the majority of the changes that you wanted to see made.
Yeah, and so my, I think this is the window, except for Pueblo and El Paso, where our odds of getting the most comments will be. It's just really getting people to make the comments on it. So that's always a challenge with our group as, so, but we'll, I mean, the plan is to reach out and encourage people if they have comments or if there's anything they think isn't how they're planning on doing it, then we would want to know that. So, and it's also, there's a few sections where we're also still waiting to see what the next round of rules looks like, and I think I indicated that, especially around the, if the voter has no ID, so. We would look for comments from the SOS as well, but I'm pretty sure they won't have time to look at any of this until that meeting, until after the 16th, I would imagine. So I guess in my, sorry, let me try one more time. I would see us finalizing on processes and having the recommendations finalized probably closer to the end of September. Then I think this is still in work in progress until then. You know, we want to learn if we learn anything from the centers and all of that until we align officially on here's what we're going to recommend. None of it takes programming. It's just all using the processes that are already in there. Does that help at all, Jesse? Or not really?
No, that sounds great. Thank you.
Okay. I can't see any of your faces, so I have no idea if I'm making it worse or if you're or what.
Hillary, this is Fran. I'm not sure the rest of our commissioners are aware that this is an exception. I know you said that, but in the past meetings, you've given updates on the entire process of how we're going to process a voter. These are exceptions to that process. In processing a voter, we run across these specific exceptions here. This is a go-along with. It's not a standalone document here.
Yeah, I hope I made that point earlier, but if not, yeah, that's a really good reminder. And again, when we, again, waiting for the commission to align, is it going to be the 9th or the 16th, to see all of it in context is the plan, is to go through what, the, you know, 98% of the voters will be doing and then the 2% exception.
Is that 2% fairly accurate?
I'm guessing at 2%. I totally made that number up. Sorry.
I like those numbers.
It's pretty small.
On that.
Mostly because we have no data with the new model of what will create, how many people will be going through the exceptions. But even based on, you know, previous elections, it's been very few, so.
So then, Hillary, this is Elena, just to make sure I understand. The plan would be either the 9th or the 16th, depending on what the commission thinks in terms of scheduling. We would then walk through the model as a whole, so look at both the standard practice and the exceptions, and then also using the kind of walkthrough of score so we can see what it looks like in practice in terms of how voters are looked up and how they're checked and all of that.
Yeah, that's the plan, so that you can actually see what an election judge would see in score when they're going through this process and walk you through the different types of voting scenarios of someone who would visit a voter service and polling center.
That sounds great. Thanks, Hillary.
So I don't know if we need to make it more clear, but is everybody okay with doing that not till the 16th?
I am.
Okay.
I am.
Okay, so we'll plan on that on the 16th. So the plan will be to do walk through the voter service and polling center, regular voters and exceptions, show you what that looks like in SCORE, and then also go through the ballot processing with mail ballots, walk you through, you know, at a higher level, you know, how they're received, the checks, move it through the process to the tabulation system.
And Hillary, this is Suzanne. Just to check, and you may have gone over this already. When you say walk us through, is it going to be like a PowerPoint, or are you going to be live on SCORE?
The hope was to be live on SCORE and have one, some of our counties come in and show them how we do that in the sandbox, set up a sandbox election.
Does a sandbox get rid of the PII issues? Because it is a public meeting, and the screen's going to be visible.
So that's new information. What we work with some of the counties who are working now that we have one more week. Sorry, that's probably more possible. We probably should do screenshots then just to be safe and redact anything that we need to.
Okay, that'd be great. Thank you.
That's a really good point. Thanks for bringing that up. And the other piece is, you know, Michael hasn't been able to join us too. We have a meeting on the 5th, and so we're still waiting for some review and feedback with him as well, so, and how it fits with rule, which we have been looking at, but.
Anything else on this one? No. All right, thanks, Hillary.
All we've got. Yep.
Looks like the next item on is the CDPHE and DOC matches. I think there may be some memos in here. Is that right, Steve?
Mm-hmm. It's just a walkthrough. Yeah.
Screenshot.
They discussed. It was one of the back of this room of business practice subjects. So.
Oh, okay. Oh, they've already discussed it? Or no?
I don't know. No one asked for the chance to.
Oh. Hillary, was this something you were going to discuss, these screenshots?
No, I'm trying to figure out where you guys are at on that.
In the past.
Sorry, I just. Give me one sec. Yeah, I'm trying to find the right. I think these were the exceptions and just talking through how that works, but we thought we would show that. That's on the chart of how we were talking about if they don't match.
Okay.
I think that the part that's still out there, and I don't know if belongs as one of our subgroups, but is we still have it on our list of figuring out what's the optimal for data, but maybe we walk through the process and then can decide that.
Yeah, because what we found out is, you know, for instance, for the death records, you know, it could be 3 days and there's no new entries, and then they get some records, and apparently they enter them every day as they come, but it's fairly mm-hmm. sporadic, and I don't know if there's a way to know that we're going to get, you know, a number of records if we download on this day versus that day, which is why we've still, we're proceeding with currently just negotiating for once a week for the 6 weeks leading up until the election, unless we hear something different about those particular records.
And any update on the Department of Correction list?
I think that, Trevor might have one.
And I thought Rick was going to look into it too, but I don't
know. Yeah, I think he was, but he's not here today.
Okay.
Trevor Timmons, CIO for the Secretary of State's office. We have opened a dialogue with folks from the, CGIS is a statewide system, the Colorado Integrated Justice Information System. They may actually be a better source of felon information than the Department of Corrections. Michael Hagahara from the election side has spoken with some folks within that office. I reached out to their CIO last Friday. He's reaching out to the line of business contacts within the Department of Corrections, as well as the technical contact, to see if CGIS may actually be a better source and maybe a more timely source. CGIS may have access to information regarding county felons and maybe federal felons that are imprisoned within and without Colorado that may actually, it may work out a little better for us to reach through them. So we've begun those discussions. Any questions?
This is Elena. Sorry, can you repeat what that stands for? I got Colorado Integrated Justice.
Sure. So I believe it's the Colorado Integrated Criminal Justice Information System. I do not believe that's a state agency. I don't know that they're an authority. They are a governmental, quasi kind of governmental entity. And they actually interface with law enforcement agencies across the state of Colorado.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, the next item on the agenda is issue tracking. Did you say we had something new on that?
That's the spreadsheet that Senator Rankin for Representative Rankin sent us.
Okay, this one? Okay. Sure. You want to go through that?
Thank you, Representative Rankin. I took the list that we had prior and put it in an Excel sheet. And then what I think we should do with this is try to work it down to some things we can actually check off. And for example, in business processes, as we go through reviewing these certain things, we can check them off and say that's done. So the attempt here is to take each of these categories and get some specific items that we can actually find closure on. So that's my attempt, and I'll continue to work on it, and hopefully with your help and input, other commission members' help and input. What I did do is take, so this is now an Excel sheet, which is available. I don't know, Stephen, if you've had time to disseminate that, but it's an Excel sheet. And so I took from the Kraft report, we had 61 items, for example, that are score modifications. Some of them are necessary for 2013, some for 2014. So if you have this Excel download, then first worksheet is actually that spreadsheet attached. So we can go through and check off those as information IT people and Secretary of State tell us that that's a working module. So that would be the kind of thing we'd like to do on all of them. And the other thing I added was I took basically all those Harvey Branscombe comments, and under public comment, I created a spreadsheet for those. So we're going to have an awful lot of that, and we'll try our best to close off on as many of the public comments as we can. But if you look at the Excel, basically sheet 3, you'll see all the Branscombe comments in a spreadsheet format, and we can sort of go through and check those off. So, that's the intent here. I'm not sure how we want to use this today, but at some point we ought to devote an hour at least and work through all these sub-items and agree on whether or not they're closed or not. So that'd be my suggestion on how we go forward with this sole idea of closing off things. I think it's critically important that we do track everything and close it off at some point in time or not. It may be some things we just never quite get around to answering, but at least we'll know what they are. So we could, if you like, we can talk through the top-level items today and see if somebody wants to add some more specificity, or we can just delay it until a later time. I think we've had a good discussion of the business process, and perhaps Hillary, you'd like to take this and create a spreadsheet of what we need to check off on as the next level down from what's on this page.
I think that would be great. I can add a sheet of what we're going to demo to you and what other processes we need to are there other processes we need to be looking at for 2014, and some of the processes are also kind of pulled out here as well. So.
Mm-hmm.
I like where this is headed. One item that I think it may overlap some of these, and I would be curious for other commissioners' opinions on this. We had the first needs assessment, and I don't know if we really pulled out all of the issues that were identified. We're about to have our second needs assessment, and I'm wondering if there isn't at least a, do we need to, we never really had a, like we did the report and we sent it off, but we didn't, I don't feel like we pulled out, here's the items we need to focus on. I think some of them have landed, but I don't know if all of them have.
Very
we're about to get our second one.
Yeah, that's a very good comment. Of course, that first item, the 61 mods to score, come out of that. And
no.
Items like security and training definitely come right out of that report. But there may be others. It's worth somebody besides me going back and looking at the CRAFT report and making sure we've captured everything in it. That would be a valuable contribution here.
Yeah, and I know, Fran, you had had some of that those questions as well, and I didn't know at this point if you could think of any of those, but I know that that's one of those things I'd like to go and review, and then this would be a great place for them.
I agree with that. I haven't gone back recently looked at it. I do know that Commissioner Rankin has a really good point. Those 61 items, they were noted, but nothing. We haven't had any updates where we are on it and what's happening with that.
Well,
understandably so.
Right. And that's critical, I mean.
Exactly, yes.
Right.
Very busy.
Understandably so.
I have a policy analyst that works in my division who is really good at pulling this kind of stuff together. He's out this week, but my thought was maybe I could have him look at this spreadsheet, the CRAFT report, and then the report we're going to put out next Tuesday, and see if he can come up with some sort of format that would be quantifiable and easy to read for us. I'm assuming you have no ownership issues with your chart.
Well, I might. I don't
yeah,
know. We'll
know.
See
That's
what he does.
I mean, his might have colors and he might have, you know, bars and graphs.
But I would be happy. I would be happy to work with your policy analyst to come to mutual agreement.
Yeah. Okay. That would be. That's fair enough.
Yeah.
So I could have him look at this and sort of track what the commission's doing and keep us online and keep reports that are open and that we can post on the website and people can see what we're doing at a glance.
Right. And his starting point should actually be the XLS spreadsheets that I sent in. So.
Yeah, and then he can pull out from the other two reports
right.
and add to it as needed and then show our progress on it.
Great.
Like a timetable. Okay.
Great.
All right, I'll have him do that.
I would like to just, on the mock election issues, I think that's finished, isn't it? So were we going to get, Hillary, were we going to get some input from the mock election results from the clerks?
Not from our end because we don't have that collective information. I mean, I can put something out and see if they saw anything, but I'm not sure. I thought that kind of got put on hold mostly because the staff at the state really needs to focus on it. Well, not really needs to, is focusing on the recall.
Yeah, and I think that is information that we're collecting and. We'll try to quantify that and have it on the agenda for, what is it, the 16th?
That's when she's doing the walkthrough.
Okay, so maybe the 16th we could look at the mock election at the same time that we look at the business practices. That would at least be after the recall.
Perhaps we could ask Trevor to take us down a next level in the security checklist.
Yeah, you missed a good one last week.
I know. Well, I heard it.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Sure. We can look at those three, and then are we going to do a meeting next Tuesday, right? Okay.
And really quickly, it was put out that we may or may not want to have a meeting the day before the recall elections.
Oh, okay.
Now, there are quite a few commissioners who will be heavily involved in that. I am not one of them, but...
I'm fine.
So I put that off to you all who are.
I'm fine canceling that if that's fine with everyone else.
It's fine.
Okay. One last thing. The Supreme Court did take the interrogatory questions we submitted. So the briefing schedule requires that all briefs of interested parties be in tomorrow at 5:30. And that's, again, on the issue of voting on the initial ballot issue of the recall. And if you don't vote on that, the Constitution says, then your vote for the successor will not count. I believe our stand is going to be that we're not sure if that's constitutional or in compliance with the federal constitution, but that we're defending it only because it appears in the Colorado Constitution. So hopefully the court's going to have a ruling out on that very quickly. We did advise the court that we needed to have a ruling by Tuesday or Wednesday, so I think that they're taking this. And Richard?
They're due by 8:30 tomorrow.
Oh, they're due by 8:30, so maybe we're going to get a ruling tomorrow.
I went back and talked to the AG's office this morning.
You need your mic on.
I found out about this first thing this morning, and then I got a copy of the interrogatories themselves that were submitted to the court, and it indicated that you guys needed an answer by tomorrow to get the ballots out. And so you look at, between you looking at that and looking at the court's order, which I have on my screen here, that says they want the briefs filed by 8:30 tomorrow morning. I suspect that they'll issue a ruling tomorrow. Would be my hunch.
Which may change the face of the ballots. So that's an issue that we'll deal with when we get that order.
September
3rd agenda. We need the report, obviously. We have to finalize it. Anything else anyone wants to see on that agenda?
The big one.
Yeah. Should we just do the report? Okay. Just put the report on.
And then question for September 3rd. Are we meeting at 1 o'clock? Is it our regular time?
Yes.
Okay.
If that works for everyone.
Great.
Okay. All right. Then we're adjourned.
Thank you.